Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Iraqi Voices. This is your host, Hassan Haddad. Iraqi Voices is produced by 1001 Iraqi Thoughts. I'm joined once again by Ali al-Mawlawi, Muhammad al-Wa'ili, and Hamza Haddad. As the political stalemate continues during the government formation process, we delve into a few different issues today, including the recent election of the governor of Salah ad-Din province. We will dive into the background of how Haytham al-Zahwan was elected as governor last week and what this means for broader national Iraqi politics. We will also talk about the recent trip to Iraq by U.S. presidential envoy Tom Barak. Finally, we will discuss the diplomatic controversy caused by Iraq submitting to the United Nations its sea coordinates. Hamza, get us up to speed on the election of the new governor of Salah ad-Din province.
So there's been a lot of controversy around the governorship of Salah ad-Din because its former governor, Badr Mahmoud al-Fahl, tried to prolong his position before taking oath in parliament. So he was governor of Salah ad-Din, ran in elections in last November, and won a seat. He was forced to resign, and the provincial council of Salah ad-Din had an interim governor. And during that time, al-Fahl actually tried to return at one point, but was prevented. And so last week, he was forced to formally take the oath and become an MP, which opened up for the provincial council to elect a new governor. And so they did on February 19th, electing Haytham al-Zahwan by 9 votes out of the 15 provincial council members. And so while that sounds like a strong enough majority, it was actually very divided. And so we saw a lot of tension between Mohammed al-Halbousi's Taqaddum party, which is where Zahwan is from, with his rival Amjad Mohammed Ahmed from Hazm Alliance, led by Muthanna Samarai. And everyone can remember, these were the two main Sunni parties that were vying for the speakership of parliament.
So now that Zahwan is officially the governor of Salah ad-Din, Ali, talk to us about the vote that took place that put him in the position and who really is the winner from that election process.
So what's really interesting about what happened in Salah ad-Din is that there were a number of different parties that came together in order to ensure that Zahwan was elected. And Zahwan himself, although he was an MP who won a seat with Sudanese Reconstruction and Development Coalition, he was in fact very close to Taqaddum, as Hamza said. But in addition to that, he was very close to Asaib Ahl al-Haq and Qais al-Khaz'ali. And so this kind of begs the question, who is he actually beholden to? And I think the answer to that is he's beholden to multiple different parties. So ostensibly, it was Abu Mazen, who heads the Jamahir party, who came out as the winner of this vote because he holds the most seats in the provincial council. And this was portrayed as a win for him. But in reality, I think that there are multiple winners from this. And it really speaks to the coalition building that happened in the run-up to the vote between a number of different parties, from Halbousi to Qais al-Khaz'ali to Muhammad Shia al-Sudani to Abu Mazen, that ultimately led to Zahwan winning his seat.
And what does it tell you when you see such alliances being formed in a small province such as Salah ad-Din, when you see Asaib and Sudani and Taqaddum and Abu Mazen coming together in order to form an alliance in order to push through Zahwan?
Well, I think the whole thing is driven by both political and economic shared interests. Of course, winning the governorship is extremely lucrative from an economic point of view because there are so many contracts that are up for grabs. And we know the level of kickbacks and bribery that occurred in order to secure the vote for Zahwan was immense. We're talking about tens of millions of dollars potentially that was spent in order to secure that vote. And I think the overall trend that we're seeing that is very indicative in Salah ad-Din is that both the Sunni and Shia parties are willing to cross that sectarian divide if it means a common political and economic interest. And this is what we've seen from what is really emerging as a camp, I would describe it as. It's not really an alliance in the sense of a formal alliance, but you can see in Salah ad-Din, there was a camp that emerged between Halbousi and Khaz'ali and Sudani primarily that led to Zahwan's election?
Radical camp politics is highly motivated by short-term interests and an attempt to get power, an attempt to seize power in every way possible. And it's not based on any ideological or principled way of looking at things, nor is it based on a specific platform. It's all about economic interest and short-term political gains. And this type of fractured politics has been the nature of the Iraqi political process for a long time. And Iraq is not able sort of to bypass that easily. But over the long term, there is hope that political process sort of gets more or is more based on principles and viewpoints about the future.
So is this short-term transactional politicking, or can we see these camps maturing into political alliances that Ali talked about? Quite a few components here. You add one, maybe two Kurdish components, and you could potentially form a government.
I would say that the transactional nature of these relationships is the initial driving force. But what we're seeing is a greater alignment in political interests between a number of different parties. And as Mohammed said, this has nothing to do with ideology or political platforms. It's purely about amassing as much political and economic influence and trying to surpass your rivals, whether that's in the Shia camp or the Sunni camp. And I would add actually that what we're seeing at a bigger level here are two broad camps emerging. If we look at not just Salah al-Din, but we look at the entire debacle over the nomination of the prime minister and those that are in favor of or opposed to the Maliki nomination, to me, what I see is a very growing generational divide between the political elite. Now, of course, that divide has existed for many years. But what I think we're seeing now is the crystallization of two very distinct camps. On the one hand, you have the old guard, which is made up of Nouri Maliki, Mas'ud Barzani, Hadi Al-Amri, Humam Hammoudi. These are the sorts of old guard politicians that made up the Iraqi opposition prior to 2003 and that have been a permanent fixture in Iraqi politics after 2003. And then you have the younger generation, people like Qais al-Khaz'ali, Hamid al-Halbousi, even Talibani, people like Kildani, the Christian political party leader. These are the sorts of individuals that I think have, through their transactional relationships that they have built over the past few years, have begun to challenge the old guard by working together. And I think we saw that in Salah al-Din. And I think we're now seeing that also with the government formation process. Because if you think about who are opposing the Maliki nomination, it's primarily Qais al-Khaz'ali and Hamid al-Halbousi, whereas the camp that is supporting the Maliki nomination are the KDP and ISKI, led by Humam Hammoudi, and even Hadi al-Amri. And I think that growing generational divide is something that we will see becoming even clearer in day-to-day politics.
What's going to be interesting about these generational alliances being non-ideologically driven is how foreign actors are going to deal with them. For example, it's oftentimes shown that if you're a Kurdish party, you're going to be more pro-Western, or if you're a Shi'i party, you're going to be seen as more Iranian-leaning. But what Ali and Mohammed have been describing completely goes against that narrative. And so it's interesting when you see an American official going to visit Mas'ud Barzani, like Tom Barak recently did, and praise his leadership, and yet he's the one who is currently backing Nouri Maliki, which the United States made very clear that they're not going to support.
Yeah, I think going forward, it's going to be even more difficult for foreign actors like the United States and Europe to navigate the complexity of Iraqi politics. Because in the past, these parties were very crudely divided between those that are pro-Western and those that are closely aligned with Iran. But I think that these two camps that are now emerging do not align clearly with either the Iran camp or the American camp. If you look at Mohammed Halbousi, for instance, he's obviously very overtly pro-Western. He was the only Sunni leader that Tom Barak visited when he was in Baghdad this week. And yet he's working hand in glove with Qais al-Khazali, whose movement is US designated and is under sanctions. And so what does that mean for the US and their dealings with someone like Halbousi? I mean, if you think about Khamis al-Khanjar, who was also sanctioned several years ago, the reason why he was sanctioned was not because he was pro-Iranian. It was because he was working very closely with groups that were very much aligned with Iran, and they were working at both a political and economic level. And this is exactly what Halbousi is doing right now with people like Qais al-Khazali, with people like Kildani, who is also US sanctioned. And so Halbousi now has to tread very carefully. There's a very difficult balancing act that he has to undertake, because on the one hand, he wants to maintain close relations with the West and with Gulf actors like Saudi Arabia and the UAE. But at the same time, it actually benefits him politically in terms of his political ascendancy to work with sanctioned groups like Asaib, like Babiliyun, and also like other groups that come from that younger generation that are closely aligned with the Hashid. And then if you look at, for instance, the other camp, the old guard camp, you also have an interesting dimension where you have now someone like Nouri al-Maliki, who Trump accused of being Iran's candidate, is now very much aligned with someone like Masoud al-Barzani, who, of course, has spent decades trying to cultivate relations with the West. And so I think there's also a psychological dimension to what is happening now, because if you think about the old guard, they know that time is not on their side, whereas the younger generation are in their 40s and 50s. The older generation are now in their 70s, and they know that the legacy of their respective political parties is under threat, because the second tier leadership of their parties doesn't have the same level of charisma, and they're going to struggle to compete with the likes of Halbousi and Khazali. And so they're now in a race against time to assert and consolidate their dominance over the political process before it's too late, before groups like Asaib and Taqaddum surpass them.
Isn't it already too late when you have Qais al-Khazali outperforming Hadi al-Amari's Badr and you have Halbousi dominating Sunni politics?
I think it depends. What we know about Iraqi politics is quite fluid, and there are lots of surprises. I mean, one dimension that Ali mentioned was the generational differences. One can also think about it in a different way. We all know that Iraq has a foreign intervention problem. This fractured power structure, or this fractured politics, might actually also be a side effect of these foreign interventions. Iraqis, regardless of to which side they lean, they want to maintain their agency. And the foreign influence is not always invited. And maybe one way, one natural reaction to counter this is for its politics and its power structure to fracture. This could be actually a natural response of the political process in order to maintain its independence, despite the fact that it's not clean and it makes things more complicated. But it makes it difficult for foreign powers to intervene, I suppose, when everything is clearly divided between two camps. And so you might see at some stage the younger generation having the upper hand, but then you might see like a comeback, the older generation using their experience and their long cultivated internal influence.
And let me add that if we think back to 2018 and the emergence of two camps in parliament, the Islah and the Bina camps, for those of us who remember that, back then those alliances were very different. In the Bina camp, you had essentially the Iran-aligned groups, including Fatah Alliance. That's when Asaib and Badr were part of the same alliance. And then you had Halbousi in that alliance as well. And that's how Halbousi actually ended up becoming speaker for the first time, is because of working with the Iran-aligned groups and securing Iran's support for his nomination. And then you had Islah, which was essentially Haider al-Abadi, Ammar al-Hakim, and the Sadrists. I think that that divide has changed significantly. There's been a recalibration of the tactical alliances that currently exist. And it's very difficult to predict whether the ascendancy of these new generation groups will continue down that path. It really depends on many factors. I mean, if you think about one of the main reasons why Asaib and Sadiqun, their political bloc, were so successful over the past 3 years, is because they were able to cultivate very close relations with the Sudani government. And Sudani gave them a lot of space to build their political and economic base. And so the ascendancy of these groups very much depends on who will be the next prime minister. We've talked about this before. The primary reason why Asaib is against the Maliki nomination is because they know that they will not gain the same level of access to government as they've enjoyed under the Sudani government. Now, that doesn't mean that Maliki is the right candidate for Iraq. And as I've said before, I don't think that he is. But it really does explain the calculations that are happening. And these emerging groups understand full well that the current trend that they are witnessing in terms of their ascendancy is not guaranteed by any measure.
I think this dynamic also plays more to parties that are not being inherited by the next generation. For example, a party like the KDP or the PUK, which is handed off to the next generation, or the sons of the leaders, let's be more clear here, I think they are able to play the long game. However, politicians that you mentioned, like Hadin Amri and Nur Maliki, their sons have made the headlines in the past. They're not front-facing politicians or have run in elections. And so they may view their legacy in a different manner.
And I think a party like the KDP understands that their next generation will not necessarily be able to compete the way that Masoud Barzani has competed. Masoud Barzani, who will inherit his father's legacy, is not popular at all in Baghdad. In fact, he barely spends any time there. The only time he comes down to Baghdad is when there's a crisis or when he's trying to secure more of the KRG's budget share. Whereas in contrast, if you look at Talibani, he spends a lot of time going back and forth from Sulaymaniyah to Baghdad. And he's been able to cultivate not just partnerships, but friendships with key politicians, both in the Sunni camp and the Shia camp. And so it's that dynamism, I think, that the younger generation have, that the old guard understand they cannot compete with that level of energy and dynamism, and that their inheritors may struggle to also keep up with what's going on in Baghdad.
So we can call this sort of like out-of-the-box politics, which deviates from the old way of doing politics. And in a sense, this is how Iraqi politics is evolving. And I think it's a positive phenomenon, but it has also some drawbacks, which is making things more complicated and actually way more complex. However, out of the complexity, a new way of doing politics in Iraq might emerge. And personally, I do believe in the process itself, as messy and as complicated it looks like from outside, and at length it can be. But as I said before, this is sort of a way for the process to protect itself from foreign intervention and not make it very accessible to foreign powers to intervene. And from that angle, I look at it as a positive development.
On the issue of legacy, one long-standing legacy issue is the relationship between Iraq and Kuwait, which we saw flare up in the last week when Iraq submitted to the United Nations Iraq's interpretation of its maritime boundary coordinates. And this kicked up a new diplomatic storm within the Gulf and the Arab region. Ali, can you please summarize what the latest developments are?
Yeah, so first of all, Iraq submitting these coordinates is a very standard procedure. It doesn't settle the maritime border dispute between Iraq and Kuwait. All it does is it asserts Iraq's interpretation of that border. And this is something that Kuwait has done in the past. In fact, Iraq should have done this years ago. But of course, any border disputes have to be settled through bilateral agreements. It's not something that the UN can adjudicate on. And so I think that the reaction by Kuwait and its Gulf allies in terms of statements and the number of statements that were pushed out in response to what Iraq did was a huge overreaction, because these states know that Iraq is not asserting its borders by force. It's simply the coordinates that it believes are Iraq's territory in the United Nations. So what we saw is not just the Gulf states, which expectedly stood with Kuwait and really issued statements of concern about what Iraq had done, stating that this was not in line with friendly relations and using all sorts of emotive language in their statements. What I think was interesting was that beyond the Gulf, even Egypt and Jordan and the Palestinian authorities issued statements siding with Kuwait on this matter.
Those latter statements by Jordan, Palestine, Egypt were a little surprising. And for me, it says a lot more about the failures of Iraqi foreign policy than it does about the states. I mean, we keep hearing about the wonderful relations that Iraq has specifically with Egypt and Jordan, and there were tripartite summits that were held in Baghdad and Amman and Cairo. And then when something as trivial as Iraq doing something technical, like submitting its interpretation of the coordinates, these states don't stand with Iraq. They stand against it.
Well, it's important to bring up the tripartite summits that Iraq, Egypt, and Jordan used to hold. It started under Adel Abdel Mehdi and then was later continued with Mustafa al-Kadhimi, and then they kind of died out under Sudani. And it makes you question how much of Iraq's foreign policy is individually driven and how much of it is broader foreign policy that's carried on. We've seen improvement with Gulf states across every administration. I think that is a positive development. But what this recent incident with Kuwait shows is that we have a long way to go. Iraq's side is never taken.
And the importance of diplomacy is even stronger here when we take into consideration that Iraq does not and should not pursue any other way than diplomacy. And so if Iraq is weak in this arena, then it's not going to be easy to enforce Iraq's right and at the same time also keep a good relationship with its neighbors. Iraq really suffers from foreign policy and has been, I think, paying the price for this. What Iraq needs is improving its ability to talk to other countries, understand their interests, make sure that others understand Iraq's interests and assert itself. These ceremonial meetups and the talks and extravagant receptions of Arab dignitaries need to be replaced with serious foreign policy that is based on principles, that is based on knowledge, that is based on good understanding of history and good negotiation skills.
Let me add that I don't think that it's about Iraq expecting its neighbors to side with Iraq over Kuwait. The expectation is just for them to remain neutral over an issue that really just concerns Iraq and Kuwait. It's a bilateral issue. I mean, don't forget that Iraq also has a border dispute with Iran. And a similar process has been undertaken in the UN where Iraq has submitted its coordinates for its border with Iran. Think back to the controversial 1975 Algiers Agreement. That border issue has still not been resolved between Iraq and Iran. And if you look back at the UN documents, when Iraq submitted its interpretation of that border, the Iranians immediately responded with a note verbale, which is essentially a diplomatic note that asserts Iran's rejection of Iraq's interpretation of the boundary. And yet you don't see all of the Gulf states take one side or the other. And so for me, this whole incident really underscores something fundamental about the post-2003 Iraq and the fact that it's still, after two decades, has not fully been embraced by its neighbors. I mean, in many ways, if you just look at the wording of these statements that have been issued, it kind of reminds you of the 2003 moment where all of Iraq's neighbors rejected this new political order, an order which represented a new Iraq, one in which all of Iraq's various communities were represented fairly in the country. And of course, this attitude by Iraq's neighbors towards the new Iraq has not fundamentally changed despite all of the diplomatic efforts and engagements and regional conferences and investments that have taken place over the past 20 years. I think what it really tells us is that much of these diplomatic efforts are an illusion to some degree, that ultimately Iraq as a country in the heart of the region has still not been fully embraced by its neighbors.
And to add on to what you're saying, Ali, I think there's a lot of missed opportunities on Iraq's side. We can talk about what others are doing or not doing to embrace Iraq in regional politics, but there are a lot of avenues that Iraq can take to improve its relations. I've written a lot in the past about how Iraq can always serve as a bridge, whether it's between Iran and its Arab neighbors, with the fact that Iraq is a majority Arab state, and yet it shares religious ties with Iran as being Shi'i. The same could be said with the ongoing tensions between the United States and Iran. Iraq is home to the largest U.S. embassy and U.S. consulate in the world, shares the largest border with Iran. Iraq could be taking advantage of its ties with both these countries to bring a solution. And so what we're always seeing is missed opportunities from the Iraqi side.
Whether it's our economy, as we discussed last week, or foreign relations, there's definitely room for improvement for Iraq. On that end, I want to thank you all for joining me today. That's it for this week's episode. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts and Spotify to receive notifications about a new episode from Iraqi Voices. If you like this episode, be sure to share it with a friend or colleague. Until the next time, take care.